First, thank you for invitation of the organizers. And second, actually, I changed the title a little bit. On the program, it says acceleration of particles in gamma ray burst shocks. And I removed shocks because I'm not sure that we are always talking about shocks. So acceleration of GRVs in general. So there are two approaches to study particle acceleration in GRVs. The first one is bottom-up. I would say, okay, mathematician's approach, we start with, okay, this is what we know, and we put in input parameters, and starting from the first principle, and then we go through very detailed numerical simulations, including particle in cell, a lot of people in the audience, and the Monte Carlo simulations, again, other people in the audience. And so this is a very elegant approach for starting from first principle and very robust. But on the other hand, because I'm happy with having the other side, I say, okay, probably the explored parameter space is limited by computational power. And also the input parameters may not be the right ones. So you can put in something, but eventually may not end up something to directly compare with the data. And for complicated systems, difficult to incorporate all the effects. The other approach is the top-down approach, basically detective's approach. This is what we see and what we can figure out and try to starting from the observations and phenomenological models. The pros is more directly related to the data, allow a much wider parameter space to explore, but the cons is uncertainty involved, and all the conclusions are subject to further confirmation from the numerical simulations. So my talk is mostly based on the second approach, starting from the data. Just a brief review, and we have already two nice talks. So for prompt emission, gamma ray bursts, the light curves are very irregular, but spectrum are very regular, just the basic power law, band function, and probably some extra component. And for afterglows, before Swift, we see very nice power law decaying optical light curves, and the spectrum is also consistent with a broken power law synchrotron spectrum. And so we came up, actually most, many people, great people, came up with this elegant picture, which is a generic fireball shock model. We really don't care about what's happening in the center, but we somehow launch a relativistic jet, and this jet can interact within itself to produce internal shocks, and this internal shock actually produced the gamma ray burst prompt emission, and then this whole fireball will be decelerated by the median and produce external shock, and that powers the smooth power law decaying afterglow. Very elegant picture. Before Swift, actually, people have managed to use broadband afterglow data to constrain the shock parameters. So this is real relativistic shocks, and one can manage to constrain, for example, epsilon E, epsilon B, which means how much energy from the shock the region goes into electrons and magnetic fields, and power law index of the electrons. It turns out not uniform, so we have a range of the P distribution and epsilon E, epsilon B, they are not, it vary from burst to burst, but the general trend is epsilon B is lower than epsilon E. We have more energy going to electrons than going to magnetic fields. However, so this was before Swift, life is not that simple. So Swift actually, as Neil already described, so this was the first revolution. Swift managed to discover the very early phase of the afterglow. So these are some interesting canonical pattern of the early afterglow light curves. You can see it is a sort of surprise. It is not a simple extrapolation of this power law component all the way to the earlier time. We see this steep decay and some plateau and then normal decay. And in almost half of the GRBs have these erratic actual flares, which means prompt emission actually does not end by the end of the burst. We still have the late time central engine activity. So we came up with more complicated afterglow picture, different components, but it's a combination of both the internal emission from the central engine and also the external shock emission. So what Swift told us is that the so-called afterglow is actually a superposition. It's not just the external shock emission. It's a superposition of the external shock and the late internal shock, internal emission, not necessarily shock, and powered by late sensation engine activity. So this is afterglow. And prompt emission is also not that simple. So it's still a mystery because we still don't know the three fundamental questions. What, which is the jet composition, are we talking about a baryonic jet or a pointing flux? And where does the GRB emission is generated? So we know it is internal. The so-called internal is basically between photosphere when the fireball, when the ejecta became transparent, and the external shock. So anywhere between this, that is internal. And the standard location is the internal shock. It's more or less 10 to the 13, 10 to 14 centimeters if you plug in the standard parameters. But it could be, because models have been proposed that emission can be right, can be generated outside, right outside the photosphere, or we can have magnetic decay right before the dissipation radius. So there's a wide range of the emission radius. And how? What? How the radiation generated? Is it synchrotron, competent scattering, or thermal, or competentized thermal emission? We don't know. So this came up with the second revolution brought by Fermi, as Dan just revealed. So very nicely, this GBM and LAT covers 6 to 7 orders of magnitudes. So already made a lot of great discoveries, including constraining Lorentz invariance violation and extra spectral component, as Dan already mentioned. But to me, there's another interesting product from the Fermi data is to constrain the GRB eject composition. To answer the question whether it is a baryonic flow or a pointing flux dominated flow. So I repeat this plot, so you can see this is a very bright burst, and by combining the GBM and the LAT data, we have this featureless band function, broken parallel spectrum covering 6 orders of magnitudes. There's no extra feature. Is it a surprise or not a surprise? So to observers, it's not a surprise because it's just a band function. We already knew this for a while, but for theorists, we have been seeking for something else. So first, we should see some pair cutoff at the high end. Second, we probably would expect to see some synchrotron self-competent in the high energy regime. And third, we should see some thermal component accompanied with the non-thermal component. Why is that? Because if the GRB is a fireball, the fireball will eventually expand and then dissipate your energy through synchrotron, through internal shocks to produce this. But before it became transparent, we should have some leftover thermal photons. Just like the Big Bang, we should expect CMB. So all those three features are missing. So Asaf Per and myself did some analysis. First, we can use this maximum energy to constrain, based on opacity argument, to constrain the, both radius and Lorentz factor. It's not just a simple Lorentz factor. But in any case, we see the emission radius is very large. If we believe that this is the same internal component, the emission radius is very large. And in particular, if it is internal shock, then the emission radius is very large. It's 10 to the 16 centimeters. And more importantly, so we can calculate how bright that thermal component is. So this is very basic. If you consider expansion of a thermal fireball, then the temperature, the observed temperature will not change too much because your Lorentz factor increases proportional to R, and your co-moving temperature drops with R, so your observed temperature is basically gamma times T prime is still a constant. So the temperature you see really doesn't matter, doesn't change too much. The area also does not change too much because the fireball expands, the total area of course is increasing with R squared, but your gamma is increasing. And what you see is only 1 over gamma cone, and it turns out you divide it by gamma squared. And it turns out those two cancels out. And then you still end up with the same area. Same temperature, same area, that tells you you expect the same luminosity. The thermal luminosity is actually very bright. So, and this luminosity should actually be brighter than what you see in a non-thermal component, because non-thermal is believed to be produced by internal shock, and it's only a small fraction of the total luminosity actually ends up in a non-thermal. So by doing this, okay, so there's more complications if your transparent radius is larger than Coase radius, then you have a decreasing factor. We already include that into account, but this is the final result. So for this particular spectrum, this is the second time epoch, B. So this is what you observe. If this is produced by a fireball, then we should expect, and if this is due to the internal shock, and we just use everything observed the quantities, then we can predict, okay, the thermal component should be this bright, much brighter than what you see. So what does this tell us? This tells us the thermal residual emission is way too bright, and we have to find some way to hide this thermal component. In order to hide this, actually a significant amount of the ejected energy is initially not in the thermal form. We have to introduce something else. And what is that something else? What we can imagine is just magnetic fields. So the flow has to be pointing flux dominated at the central engine. And if we define this famous sigma parameter, which is pointing flux over baryonic flux, and we actually require that the sigma has to be at least 20, which means only the baryonic component gives you a hot thermal component. In that way, you can make your thermal component much dimmer to be hidden beneath what you observe. So for this particular burst, sigma actually has to be about 20 or 15. By invoking a pointing flux dominated flow, actually we can kill three birds with one stone. So I'm saying that we are missing three things. But if you have a pointing flux, then there's no detection of the pair cutoff because the emission radius is very large, so opacity is not that high. SSC, of course, if B is very strong, you have more energy in magnetic fields than photons, so you don't see the SSC. And finally, you don't see the photosphere emission because it's pointing flux dominated. So this is, to me, is the most elegant picture to interpret this event. Now, if the ejecta is magnetized, then we probably would also expect a magnetized reverse shock, because as the ejecta is decelerated, we should have a reverse shock, and probably that reverse shock carries some primordial magnetic fields as well. Talking about reverse shock, the first case was 1901-23, the famous case, and Akhlov et al. Discovered this bright optical flash, and Mazzaro Reese, Sari Piran proposed the reverse shock interpretation. Later on, they just say, okay, this component can be interpreted by reverse shock. And later on, we said, okay, what about, we want to interpret both this and this. This is forward shock. So in order to interpret both reverse and forward shocks, our conclusion is that we really need the reverse shock to be more magnetized. The strength of magnetic fields in the reverse shock region has to be 15 times stronger than the magnetic field in the forward shock region. This was not the only case. We also have O2-12-11, and again, two different groups also got the same conclusion. So in general, just based on the light curves, we say, okay, so the optical light curve should look something like this. We got a reverse and forward shock components. If the reverse shock dominates, and something like what we see in 1901-23, in this case, we really need magnetized reverse shock. Otherwise, the light curve should look like this. We already saw several cases of these. And then a natural prediction is, okay, this is magnetized and we should really see some signature. So this component should be linearly polarized. And actually this was recently proven. A very exciting discovery reported at the recent Venice meeting was that the Liverpool group, actually they look at 090102 and they were able to measure the optical polarization very early on. and then they found 10 plus 1% polarization. So this was a great confirmation of the magnetized ejecta. Okay, so which model best describes GRB prompt emission? So in the literature, there are three types. The first one is low sigma baryonic, basically this is the internal shock. Sigma much, much less than one. And Maxim Lutikov and Roger Blanford proposed the electromagnetic model. So this is another extreme, sigma is very large. And there's the intermediate sigma regime MHD model. So I'll briefly discuss this. The internal shock model, it has been discussed for a very long time, but there are some good aspects, other advantage which I like. Naturally expected in the unsteady outflow, very easy to imagine something colliding with each other. And variability related to the central engine. So what we see, the variability from light curve is related to the variability in the central engine. And actually this is already confirmed by the observation X-ray flare data. We really know that the central engine is restarting. So we did this exercise. If this is due to the curvature effect after the emission, then we look for the starting point of that time, and it turns purely data analysis, and that time is right before the flare, which means the central engine is really restarting. So this is very nice aspect for the internal shock. However, the internal shock model has a lot of difficulties. The first one is the low efficiency, which means, so this is a recent calculation. We try to calculate everything, just generate a bunch of shells and produce internal shock, prompt emission, X-ray flares, and afterglow. And it turns out, this is what we got. The internal shock, we can get a prompt emission, but the afterglow is very bright. So we don't see the steep decay phase. So in order to produce steep decay phase, we really need very high efficiency, which is not predicted by the internal shock model. The second component is missing electrons. In order to reproduce the right E peak or synchrotron self-absorption, this is very detailed, but we need only a small fraction of electrons being accelerated. We have assumed that most of the electrons are not accelerated. The third one is the fast cooling problem, because once the shock crosses accelerated particles, the magnetic field is so strong and particles will quickly cool down. So we predict that the low energy photon index should be -3.5, but observations show that a lot of them actually are shallower than that. There's another detail, GRBs are harder if they are more energetic within the internal shock model, so EP proportional L to 1/2, but there's R parameter. We really need this distance, dissipation distance, to be constant in order to interpret this, but the internal shock model cannot do this. And finally, internal shock model, there's a missing photosphere problem I just mentioned. And the electromagnetic model, this is an excellent idea, and a lot of pros, high efficiency, weak photosphere, large emission radius, which is consistent with the data. And the cons is the variability is not related to central engine, which seems like currently supported by the data. And another issue is, okay, very high sigma. If we can have a magnetized engine, can we reach this high sigma, or sigma is lower than this? And MHD models, they initially have high sigma, but quickly convert to low sigma, then it still end up with internal shocks. So it's not that different from the internal shocks. So this is something I'm trying to propose, actually some sort of preliminary idea. Maybe one can combine the merits of internal shocks and the magnetic dissipation models. So the general picture is like this. We still require that our central engine eject some shells, and these shells have different Lorentz factor, they can collide, but these shells are high sigma ones with typical Lorentz factor of a few tens, say. And they can normally collide just like the internal shocks, but some of them, if their relative Lorentz factor is not that large, there's nothing happens. They probably have some elastic collision, and that's it. But if their relative Lorentz factor is large, so that the relative Lorentz factor is greater than the Elfin Lorentz factor, and shock may actually start to drive some turbulence. And then the reconnection is going on, but maybe there's a trigger effect so that you can have a runaway reconnection and turbulence so that you can release the, just like cascade process in the pulsar. So you can have a sudden release of magnetic energy to produce a gamma ray burst. And finally, your sigma drops to around unity. So by the end of it, the eject is still magnetized, and this is consistent with the optical polarization data. So this model, of course, carries the merits of the internal shock model because we still have this central engine driven variability. But on the other hand, it overcomes the difficulties of the internal shock model and also carries the merits of the electromagnetic model. So we got high efficiency, we got electron number problem solved. We don't need to assume that only a small fraction of electrons are accelerated because the electron number is small in the beginning, because most of the energy is in electromagnetic in magnetic fields. And the turbulent heating probably can overcome the fast cooling problem. We have a continuous heating, and the Amati relation can be naturally interpreted because the small radius collisions does not count. We only have count for the large radius collision, so we can naturally produce Amati relation. So, and also there's no missing photosphere problem. So this is very preliminary idea, but probably along the line of what we observed. But what is new feature? Can we tell this model from the others? What I can think of is there could be two variability components. So one is, so for such kind of model, we have two components. One is related to the central engine. So look at this gamma ray burst. So we have these broad humps. So this is probably related to the central engine activity. But on top of the broad humps, we have this very rapid variability. Probably that is related to the turbulence or jet in the jet. So to summarize, because I was asked to talk about particle accelerating in GRBs. So I pull out three slides. The first one is about the forward shock. A relativistic forward shock, this one we definitely know, it is a shock, it is relativistic, and it's plowing into a circumburst medium, and it is responsible for the power law decay afterglow. So we know that a power law distribution of electrons are accelerated, that we know. Non-uniform electron power law index P, so from case to case, any model needs to produce different number of P, cannot have that get a universal P. And also non-uniform epsilon B, but probably epsilon E is greater than epsilon B. So this is what we can learn from the afterglow study. And it seems that this is partially reproduced by the numerical simulations. Partially, I mean the current setup is still not exactly what is happening there. For example, we really need to deal with electron ion or electron proton plasma and the large density contrast and also the high Lorentz factor. But the general trend of current peak simulation seems to reproduce what is observed there. The second summary is the regarding the reverse shock. At least for some GRBs like 09, 01, 02, we saw this strongly magnetized, polarized reverse shock emission. So we really need to have a particle acceleration in moderate sigma. So one probably needs to allow particle acceleration, but Sironi and Spikowski has claimed that when you reach sigma 0.01, it is difficult to accelerate particles. But on the other hand, the reverse shock is not that relativistic. It's trans-relativistic, maybe Lorentz factor of 1.5 to 2. So this is probably the reason that you can get to the particles there. The final summary is regarding prompt emission. We know the least, but at least for this one, I think we have a good clue that it has to be pointing flux dominated. So one probably needs to accelerate particles without shocks, maybe through reconnection and turbulence in high gamma, high sigma regime, and numerical model are not developed it that far yet. So we need MHD simulation in high gamma, high sigma, peak simulation in high gamma, high sigma regime. So the bottom line is many questions for numerical simulations to address. Thank you.
Accelerated particles. And most of the time, this is parameterized as an incoming energy, related to incoming energy. Now, justification comes from observations, well, at least in astrophysics, the justification comes from observations of space shocks. But we just heard that sometimes these shocks in the interplanetary medium are very capricious. Sometimes there is a strong shock that doesn't do acceleration, and then a weak shock comes in, and you see accelerated particles. So this is all very frustrating. And I don't have a good answer to other. I just would like to point out that the simple prescriptions that I used most of the time, you know, there are examples where they don't work.
Yeah, I fully agree that bursts are different from burst to burst, and maybe that's thermal bomb, that is a standard fireball. But what I'm going to say is, yes, indeed, some of the bursts already ask us to consider along the different lines. The nature is very complicated.
Any other questions? I can't tell who you are, but...
I think you're...
So you postulated that by reconnection and turbulence you can get in a time that you require from high sigma to low sigma, right? But it's like nothing computed, so...
Exactly, I'm hand waving.
You can also do it with mass loading, I believe.
Sorry?
I think you can also do it with mass loading, right?
Mass loading, yeah.
Next question.
Yeah, a question about with the photosphere, or with the pointing flux model, how would you interpret the a spectral cutoff if that is seen? I mean, if it's happening at a large radius, the compactness problem seems to be solved in that sense. How would you interpret the rollover?
Yeah, so the opacity depends on both R and gamma. So even if R is large, if your gamma is not that large, then it can still have a cutoff.
When we do models of shock acceleration, we kind of know what we're aiming for. There is a prediction for a power law slope. What are we aiming for in this kind of thing? Are you predicting some sort of universal power law, or from observations, what do we infer about
it? From an observation point of view, no. So what is relevant here is the beta part of the spectrum, which has a distribution as well. Then the alpha part, there could be due to some mechanism like jitter emission, like Misha is discussing, or could be some continuous heating. And maybe, ideally, I think if one can come up with a mechanism to produce electron index around one, that will solve the problem.
Sorry, before we finish, there is an announcement. Right after the following session, we will have a poster session combined with a reception. So get your drinks and go and visit the poster session after the following session. Okay.
Intermission now. We reconvene at 4:59.